Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. How do we start this again, Mara?
Live from
New York City. This is Wisdom of the Sages, a daily yoga podcast. Today I'm your host, Kaustubh Das, and unfortunately, for some days, we're going to be missing my brother from another mother, Raghunath, whose book, From Punk to Monk, was just released yesterday officially. It's arriving in everyone's mailboxes. People are getting it. And he's out on a promotional tour, right? He's doing concerts with his band. Both bands, yep.
Shelter and Youth of Today.
And he's also doing like kind of like, I guess, book events too, right?
Yeah, that's right. And some kirtans too. Kirtans, okay, yoga events, book signings. Well,
I thought I was going to be all alone. I thought you were going to go too, but I'm happy to hear that you're with us this week. Yeah.
Happy to be here.
Okay. And we got for this week lined up, we have a very special guest today that I'll mention in a moment. And tomorrow and Friday, we'll have the spiritual scientist, Chaitanya Charan, on the show. And so I think that'll be good. We're going to just, rather than usually when we've had him on in the past, we've interviewed him on different subjects. But I think we're just going to like read Bhagavatam together with him, just like we would do on a normal day.
Great.
Looking forward to that. And we're trying to line up a couple things further down. Raghunath gets back, I think, like a week from today.
Flies back a week from today, so he's back on the show a week from tomorrow.
Okay, so we'll try to fill it in the best we can. We'll probably miss a few days, but we'll fill it in the best that we can. All right, any announcements today, Mara?
Yeah, we have some Bhakti Recovery Group meetings at 1 and 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay, and that's it for now?
Yep.
Okay, so, you know, today we have a very, very special guest, someone that we've wanted to have on the show for a long time, and we finally got around to making it happen. It's Krishna Kshetra Swami, who's someone that I've known for many, many, many years, and someone I've always deeply admired as a sannyasi, as a renunciate, as a scholar, and most particularly just as a yogi, as a bhakti yogi. Krishna Kshetra Swami, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kaustubh. I'm happy and, I must say, honored to be here with you.
The honor is all ours.
But I feel a little bit intimidated by the title of your podcast, Wisdom of the Sages. It's like, okay, where do I fit into this?
Well... We always tried to make it clear from the first show that when we say Wisdom of the Sages, we mean that the sages are in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam.
Right, okay.
And so we're presenting them, but certainly you would live up to our standard of a wise sage, well, and that's why we brought you on today.
To the extent that I try to let some of that wisdom from the Bhagavatam rub off, I guess, if that counts.
It certainly does. Let me just read a little bio about you, if you don't mind. So Krishna Kshetra Swami is a Vaishnava, a bhakti yogi since 1972, and a disciple of Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In 2014, he accepted the formal vows of a sannyasi, of a lifelong renunciate monk as a bhakti yogi. He completed his PhD at the University of Oxford with a study of Vaishnava temple liturgical practices and theology. He is a research fellow of the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies and a research fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics. As a co-director, I always greatly admire the ethical animals, and I don't know how you communicate with them about ethics, but that sounds like a wonderful service. No, of course, it has to do with how we treat animals, but I'm sure you can communicate with them in all different ways. he was as a co-director of the Bhagavad, is it the Bhagavad Purana?
Research project.
He's a co-director of the Bhagavad Purana Research Project, along with Professor Ravi M. Gupta, And together they edited a volume of articles and translated a volume of selections of the Bhagavad Purana, the Srimad Bhagavatam that we read here every day on the show. Both volumes were published by Columbia University Press. So his books include Attending Krishna's Image, Chaitanya Vaishnava Murti Seva as Devotional Truth, the Bhagavad Purana, Sacred Text and Living Tradition, Cow Care in Indian in Hindu Animal Ethics, and Advancing Across the Great River, Reflections on Yoga Philosophy and Cross-Cultural Comparisons. And those books, they go by the name that you use in your academic world, Kenneth R. Valpe.
Right. Yes. Well, I have two hats, and I switch them back and forth sometimes.
Okay. When you walk into the university, you're... Yeah. Professor Valpe, and when you walk into the temple, you're Krishna Kshetra Swami, yes. Something like that,
generally.
Okay. But certainly all your studies seem to be in the realm that's related to your devotional life.
Yes, and I feel quite fortunate that I've been able to bring these two worlds together, so to say. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that it seemed to me that when I first started practicing bhakti back in the late 80s and through the 90s, I always got the impression, and you know what, it's a distant impression, so it may not be so accurate, but that the academic world was a little bit more hostile to religion and spirituality, and that maybe it's a bit more open to it now?
Yes, I would say so. I've been fortunate in my time that I've been in the academic world. I've been fortunate to connect with scholars who I would say are very much religiously, spiritually inclined, mm-hmm. some of them very much committed to their own traditions. My doctoral supervisor, I think you know, Frank Clooney.
I have met him before, yes. Yeah,
he's, of course, a very committed Roman Catholic, but he's also a scholar of Vaishnavism, and he's especially known for his comparative theology, in which he's been a trailblazer. Anyway, he's one example of such a person I've found very, how to say, maybe accommodating. Mm-hmm. But you get all kinds.
Well, I've always known you as such a gentle person, so I'm happy that at least some receive you and honor your genuine devotion in the world that you operate in as an academic. Mm. Especially what I would like to get into today, Maharaj, is speaking about, you know, we read Srimad Bhagavatam here on a daily as Wisdom of the Sages. So it's a study. You know, it has its educational function for us, and we come here to learn lessons. It's also a sadhana for us. Mm-hmm. It's a daily practice through which we, you know, intend to purify our minds, purify our thoughts, uplift our minds and hearts. Mm-hmm. So this text becomes so is so fundamental to our podcast and our community. You can say our daily gathering. In yoga circles, particularly in the Western world, certain books are well known. Of course, Bhagavad Gita, perhaps you know the most well known book, and of course a very important text to us as Bhakti Yogis. The Yoga Sutras are very you know spoken of often, but we don't hear Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, most people aren't even familiar with that name, the Srimad Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Purana.
Right.
But of course, it's such an important text. Could you just speak a little bit about the importance of the Srimad Bhagavatam? What is unique about it? Why is it considered important?
Mm. Let's see where to start. one of the sages of the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, you've probably referred to sometimes here, is Sanatan Goswami.
Mm-hmm. One of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan.
And he wrote an amazing book of prayers in which he, at the very end or almost end of the book, he has, I think it's five stanzas praising the Bhagavatam.
Okay.
And one of these I've been trying to memorize. Let's see if I can do it. Paramananda Pataya Prema Varshyaksharaya Te Sarvada Sarvasevyaya Sri Krishnaya Namostu Me.
Can I try to translate that?
Sure.
We're really taking a stab at it. Give me the first line again.
Paramananda Pataya.
So the highest bliss is derived through hearing it? Something like that?
Yes, you could say like that, yes.
And the second line?
Prema Varshi Aksharaya Te.
Well, it helps you. Do you see prema?
No, you get
prema in your eyes. You see through the eyes of love, like that.
We give you credit for a good try.
Okay, maybe I should just give up now. No, please share with us.
No, the second half will be easier.
Okay, okay. Let's see.
An akshara is a Sanskrit letter. Literally, it means that which cannot be broken. But it refers to the Sanskrit alphabet. And Varsha is rain. And Varshi Aksha is a rain of letters. So unto you whose rain of letters brings prema, brings love.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then, then Sarvada, Sarvasevyaya.
You give everything, you give service, or something like that?
Good try.
Okay.
No, I mean, you're doing probably better than
even
I would
that,
do
I'm happy
without,
with.
I, you know, I always need to see it. Seva, of course, means service, but sevya means to be served.
Oh, to be served, okay.
And so, and sarvada means always, like
sarvada,
like yada and tada and sarvada. Excuse me. So, and sarva means all. So, you are always servable by everyone.
Okay. Like, in other words, always worthy of service from everyone.
Right.
There's no one that's beyond the there's no one beyond you that's beyond the role of your servant.
Yeah, exactly. There's no one who, there's no excuse.
For anyone.
Everyone can serve you.
Okay. Interesting.
And then just Sri Krishnaya namos astu me.
Unto Krishna, I astu me. Unto Krishna, I offer my respects. Something.
Yes, but because the prayer is to the Bhagavatam, it's saying that you who are Krishna, who are the glorious or the opulent Krishna, Sri Krishnaya. Namaha, obeisance, astu, let there be, may, by me.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the whole translation?
All of that together.
Okay.
No, it's just giving. The Bhagavatam brings the supreme bliss by reading it. It is a shower of prema. With every letter, with every word, it's can be served, or you can be served, because it's all in the dative case. It's addressing the Bhagavatam. You can be served by everyone at all times, and you are this. You are Lord Krishna. To you, I offer obeisance. Something like
beautiful.
That.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, when I hear a verse like that, the immediate reaction can be like, "Oh, it's a verse of praise." Mm-hmm. It's using that language of praise, and it's natural that when we give praise, there's always you know all that honor and glory being spoken of, but I would imagine that also all of these things are very specific as well. Like, in other words, to say Paramananda, that you give the highest bliss, it refers not only, it's not only just like a glorification, but it's comparing that bliss to bliss that may be found elsewhere.
Mm. Yes, Parama is, you can't get better than Parama.
but I suppose what I'm getting at is, would you view that as like a direct statement that's saying, like, in other places, in other texts, even in the other Vedic texts and in the other Puranas and so on, it speaks about bliss that can be derived in different ways. Mm-hmm. But the bliss of bhakti that's found, especially and particularly in the Bhagavatam, is something beyond, say, like the bliss of Brahman that you might find in other texts.
Yeah, certainly he's saying that, but he's also, I was saying this comes at the end of his book, Shri Krishna Lila Stava, in which he's addressing Krishna in the entire, I think it's more than 400 verses, all in the vocative case. That means he's directly addressing the Lord and praising him through, by referring to him in terms of his different leelas, his different pastimes, all of which are described in the Bhagavatam. And so he's saying, in effect, just look at all of this bliss that you have just experienced by reading about Krishna. Now, just imagine you can also go to the Bhagavatam directly, and this is, you'll find more of this and more.
I see. Okay, that's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, this is a topic that kind of fascinates me, just as being a person that kind of speaks about bhakti and speaks in yoga circles in the Western world, like this key, in a sense, that's given to us through the Srimad Bhagavatam, where there are so many texts coming in from the same author, from Vyasadeva. And it seems to be recommending so many different ideas, you know, so many different practices, and or even general categories of teaching, or, you know, of each with a different purpose. And commonly those get categorized into like the karma kandya, you know, like people that see this world as a place for their own enjoyment, and but they want to approach it in the wisest and most harmonious way with nature. So there are rituals and so on that they can perform to receive all the blessings, material blessings in this world. And then there's like the books that's, you know, like more like the Upanishads that speak to jnana, that let's really analyze this world. Let's analyze the material happiness that we've been deriving through our sacrifices, through our rituals, and recognize that with all whatever pleasures of this world we receive, that there's always suffering that comes along with them, and the wiser person just lets go of these things. Mm-hmm. And then there's something still you know, beyond that, there's these bhakti teachings that even that renouncing of this world is, in one sense, it's very accomplished if one can achieve that, but it still hasn't gotten to our very essence, which is divine love.
Yeah.
And that the Bhagavatam goes there, you know.
One thing what you just said reminded me of another verse that's in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto toward almost, I think, the end of chapter 3, describing sort of the situation in which the Bhagavatam arises. It's compared to the rising of the sun, Krishne Svadamo Pagate Dharma Jnana Dibisaha, that Krishna has departed the world, but he didn't depart alone. He took with him dharma and jnana. He took all the good things that we, or what we think are good in this world, he took them with him. and so what to do? Kalo nashta drisham asia, in this age of Kali, in which Krishna's not there, in which dharma and jnana, knowledge and religiosity are no longer there. So then what? Kalo nashta drisham asia, purana arka aduna udita. Now, aduna, udita has arisen, this Purana Arka, this Purana Sun, and of course it's referring to the Bhagavatam. So it's giving this image of the Bhagavatam being like the sun, brilliant like the sun. It rises and makes everything clear.
Mm-hmm. You earlier were speaking, you know, obviously it's such a large text. And even like, say, the Bhagavad Gita, which is merely 700 verses, people commonly speak of Bhagavad Gita as a text that you can go back to again and again and again throughout your life. And it's, you know, uncannily people find that it speaks to them in different ways on deeper levels. They see things, they understand things that they didn't understand before. And certainly with a text like Bhagavatam, which is, you know, so many thousands of verses, and infinitely deep, there's going to be so many ways that we can read it, and so many thoughts, lessons, ideas, blessings that we can derive through it. You were speaking to me about something that I no one had ever kind of revealed to me before, but you were speaking about different ways that people are received in the Bhagavatam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And ideas that we can derive from that. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Okay. yes, this is kind of one of my favorite ways of appreciating the Bhagavatam. As I've, over the years, gone through it, to me, this is something that keeps coming out and calling my attention. It's what in literary circles might be called a trope, a certain sort of form of narrative, or having this, some essential features. So what I find in the Bhagavatam is this, in so many different ways, so many different forms, what I call the trope of reception, or the trope of hospitality, but it's one which has invariably a positive, or in other cases, a negative presentation. What do I mean by this? Well, let's start with the negative case of the king, Maharaj Parikshit, in the end of the first canto, is out hunting, as kings are wont to do. He's been chasing a deer. According to the Mahabharata, he has wounded a deer, and the deer has run off, and he's chasing. And as he's chasing, he comes to an ashram, and it's the ashram of Shamika Rishi, who at that time is you could say very busy. How is he busy? He's busy being completely absorbed in meditation.
So he's like in a trance, essentially.
Well, that's the question.
Okay.
We come to understand, yes, he's in a trance, or at least, and again, this goes to the Mahabharata, he has made a vow of silence.
Okay.
So the king comes. He doesn't know any of this. The king is tired, he's hungry, and he's thirsty. And he's the king, so he's accustomed to being received with all honors. And now he's being completely and thoroughly ignored.
Yeah.
And what is his response? He feels some impatience, and he wants to show his impatience. And there happens to be a dead snake lying nearby. He picks it up with the tip of his bow, and he drapes it over the neck of the sage, and he turns away and leaves in a huff.
Hmm. That was kind of a almost like a sarcastic way of, garlanding someone. Like you would garland a guest with flowers. He was kind of yeah. like, oh, you received me so well. Let me receive you well. In a sense, is that what he was saying?
Yes, you could say like that. There's a kind of irony in it. And of course, as I think most of your listeners will know, what happens is that the king is cursed by the son of this sage. What is the curse? That he will die in 7 days. And the king is informed of this. And in the Bhagavatam, and I have to say this is a little different description than in the Mahabharata, but that's another topic. He fully accepts the curse. He says, all right, that's it. It's time to go. And he prepares himself. He leaves everything, his kingdom, and he goes to the bank of the Ganga. Or is it the Yamuna? I never know.
Well, it's hard to figure that one out, right? Because he was in Hastinapur, which is Delhi. So you'd think it'd be Yamuna, but it says Ganga.
Yeah. And as we know, there he meets Shuka. We call him Shukadeva Goswami, where it's a complete opposite sort of reception. In this case, now the king, the Kshatriya, is receiving the sage, and the sage, like Shamika, is not saying anything. But he's immediately recognized for what he is, that he is the exalted sage who can fully respond to the needs of the king in his final days of preparing to die. But going back to the first reception, or failed reception, if you like, what I think is interesting here, and which is interesting in many of the we might say troubled receptions in the Bhagavatam, is that there is some assumption made. There is a misperception. there is a judgment made which turns out to be inaccurate, inappropriate. Excuse me. In this case, the king is suspicious that the sage is not really meditating, that he just wants to avoid having to deal with a king.
Receiving him.
Yeah, oh, it's too much trouble. And so he...
We've all felt that way, perhaps, at one point or another.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the sort of related theme to this, there is this idea in the, broadly speaking, Vedic and post-Vedic literature that especially for householders, and in this case, Shamika is, he's a rishi and he's also a householder, is that it's considered a very important duty to receive guests, not just invited guests, not just pre-announced, but unexpected guests. And this is sometimes referred to as atiti seva, service to unexpected guests. And there is the understanding that particularly an unexpected guest just might be the Supreme Lord himself coming in disguise just to test us.
Right.
And so especially the householder is enjoined or is encouraged to be ready and to have a genuine sense of welcome. I am fortunate to have this guest. And indeed, I see this guest as a representative of the Lord. And my home is being blessed by this person, and so on. So there's so many different occasions in the Bhagavatam. If we jump to the third skanda, the third canto, the four kumaras, again, sages now, and of course the Bhagavatam is very much about kings and sages meeting. So, yes. As again, I'm sure your listeners know, the four Kumaras are on a tour to visit Vaikuntha. They've gone through six of the seven gates of Vaikuntha, and
Vaikuntha being the spiritual world, you can say, exiting the material and entering the spiritual realm of devotion.
And these four sages are appearing like 5-year-old or less children, and being who they are, their uniform is their skin. They are completely naked. And Jai and Vijay, who are the guards at the door of the pearly gates, and they say, "Wait, where do you think you're going? You don't know the dress code in Vaikuntha." And there are some sharp words exchanged. And that leads to an extended pastime. As we know, these two guards will have to leave their position to come to the temporal world where they are going to be the cause of so much trouble, and then they will be met by the Lord, who will personally end their lives, not once, but in three different lives. All of that starts by an awkward reception. All of that starts with a misperception of these four sages. They don't know that these are sages. And, you know, you could imagine, you can ask yourself, well, what if they had responded in a different way? What if they had said, excuse me, can you kindly identify yourselves? And, you know, they could have had a polite discussion, right? Instead of saying, stop, you cannot come in. Making presumptions and then acting in ways which have a high cost is something which you find in the Bhagavata Purana, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, several times, I would say. There's a domino effect. One bad word, one bad action, and it leads to so much trouble. Another problematic reception. My mind goes for the troubles. We can also talk about the nice receptions in the Bhagavatam. But another troubled one is that Indra, this is in the sixth canto, Indra is in his palace. He's the lord of, he's sometimes called the king of heaven. And he's surrounded by his admirers, and the dancing girls are dancing and the singers are singing. And his guru walks in. Indra is his teacher, walks in, but is his teacher, but Indra does not notice because he's distracted. Mm-hmm. So it would have been proper for him to stop everything immediately, to stand and to offer obeisance to his guru, Brihaspati. But he completely ignores him. Brihaspati sees the situation and he quietly leaves. After he leaves, Indra understands, oh, I blew it. And he tries to fix it, but it's too late. And the consequences are practically endless. They go on for chapter after after chapter of troubles.
It's brutal poor Indra goes through.
Yeah. So in this case, what is the lesson? The lesson is, you can say, be careful about being in a situation where you find yourself, the focus of attention by admirers or appreciators or friends, and someone who ought to be respected, you neglect as a result. That could be a simple case. Now, let's go to a good reception and go back to the first canto, because
it's done right.
Enough bad news, I think, for a while. Narada's mother in Narada's previous life. We never hear what her name was, for whatever reason, but she has received these sages, several sages. We don't know the number, but apparently a few of them. Swami Prabhupada calls them the Bhakti Vedantas. So she receives them apparently for some time during the rainy season, and hosts them and serves them in so many different ways. And her son, and we don't know his name before he becomes Narada, but as her son, he assists her. And while he's assisting her, he is, of course, benefiting from their sangha, from their association. And that becomes his sort of ticket to eventually, in his next life, become Narada. So in this case, one good reception, one positive hospitality, leads to, a glorious story.
Result.
Yes.
Yeah. He becomes Narada, the sage amongst the devas in his next life.
Yes. And then through the Bhagavatam, Narada is giving so much spiritual teaching. He appears several times.
Maharaj, let me ask you something. Focusing on this idea, you open this up by using the word hospitality. Mm-hmm. And so, and you're drawing our attention to ways that people are greeted in Bhagavatam, and such an important text that's really the culmination, we understand it, as the culmination of all of the yoga philosophy that Vyasadeva gives us. Mm-hmm. And you're drawing our attention to say, look at that text where we finally get to the full conclusion of it. It's giving us examples of receptions, people greeting others. We're looking at the hospitality, the quality of the hospitality of different people, and we're seeing that there's a focus on that. And you mentioned how in India, just in general in India, this idea has been deeply instilled, I think, and you still find it that many times in India, I've been invited to stay, to eat, or even to stay in the homes of people that had just met me, mm-hmm. right? They were just like, please come and stay in my home.
Yeah.
There's such a conviction that's been instilled that this will bring auspiciousness to them, to their family, if they honor people this way. Right. And I was wondering, you know, one of your fields of study and practice is the temple worship, the rituals that are done within a temple wherein different offerings are made to the forms in the temple as offerings made to God. Mm-hmm. And there we see that those offerings, within the ritual, sometimes it's 16 offerings are made, sometimes it's 64 offerings that are made. But they seem to align very much with the mood of how you would receive a guest in your home, the types of things that are offered and perhaps the mood that one should have.
That's what it's very much about. Archana, as it's called, the sort of umbrella term for temple worship, it can be understood in terms of hospitality, but in this case, it's hospitality for none other than God.
Yes. Yeah. And it seems that, again, we come to this, what we understand is the pinnacle, the cream of all the Vedic teachings, yeah. the commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which is, you know, the essence of all Vedanta. And when we get there, certainly philosophy is there. Certainly a deep philosophy is there, but it's being expressed through quite a few examples of hospitality. The I guess you could say the state of one's heart as expressed through greeting another human being. And that's somehow become so essential to the practice of yoga.
Yes, because what is yoga? One way to understand it is as a process of purifying the core of our being, which in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali is referred to, again, with a kind of umbrella term, namely citta. And so... We can think of yoga as the process. He says yogas chitta vritti nirodha, you know, to mm-hmm. sort of draw back from the vrittis, the engagements, the fluctuations of the mind. But why is that important? Because we're looking for the purity of the heart, of chitta, which is often translated as heart. Chitta is kind of an aggregate of manas, buddhi, and ahamkara, and sometimes antaryamin is referred to. So technical terms for mind and intelligence and the idea of being the doer. ahankara. But in the Bhagavatam, what becomes much more clear, I think, than in Patanjali Yoga Sutras, who's kind of pointing in this way, but, you know, he's being very little bit cryptic, is
yes.
The idea is to clear the heart, to welcome in the heart the Lord. That the Lord...
As a host would receive a guest.
Exactly.
In a sense.
And, of course, in this case, we can say, yes, but the Lord is already there. Yes, but you don't know it.
We haven't received him.
We haven't received him. So the reception, the process that's there in the ritual literature is really pointing toward that idea.
And
the Bhagavatam is giving this in narrative form, and where the receptions go wrong, it's pratikulyasya varjanam. It's showing what to avoid.
So this is very interesting to me. So in other words, we may pick up on those same rituals or very similar types of ritual in the Vedas, where the emphasis is on if you perform these rituals nicely, you will receive all the things of this world. You can have the birth of a healthy child. You can have rains for your crops. You can have wealth. You could have a very auspicious birth in your next life, full of pleasure. And you could learn those rituals. But when we get to the Bhagavatam, it can speak about the same or similar rituals, but from a much deeper understanding that has to do with preparing your heart to receive God with the deepest type of love and achieve the very highest goal in life.
Yes, that's what I would say. If you, if we go to the third canto, I think it's chapter 28, there's an amazing meditation. It's like a guided meditation. On the form of Vishnu, going step by step from the feet, the lotus feet, gradually up the body to the face, to the smile, to the laughter of the Lord, and all of this it's a meditation. It's specific. It's in the context of yoga as meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I think it becomes very explicit that this is what the Bhagavatam is offering.
Very interesting, and that idea, you know, Maharaj, this is, I'm sure it's something that you haven't heard of, but Raghunath and I, we always shared and laughed about. There's one comedian, current, modern, popular comedian. And he did one. He was doing a stand-up routine, and he was comparing what hospitality was like when he was growing up to what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, when I was a kid, when someone came to your door, that was like a good thing, and we called it company. We're having company today, and they could just they could just drop in unexpected, and your mother always kept like some crumb cake. In the house that you weren't allowed to touch because company might come, and you had to be ready for them when they come, and they would make a little sanka and serve some crumb cake, and everyone would gather around and be say like, oh, we haven't seen you in so long. It's so great to have you here. And then he said, nowadays, if someone knocks on your door, everybody's like, duck. don't even let them know that we're here. Did you invite anybody over? Who is that?
When I was a kid, we never locked the door.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Unless we were going away for some days, the whole family. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, door was unlocked.
And I find it really interesting that when we get, again, we're getting to this, that idea in Indian culture that, I think, and maybe you can speak to this a bit, but it seems to me like there's things that people would look at and call them superstition. And a tradition may even kind of like solidify a certain superstitious ideas for our own good. You know, like there may be certain superstitions we have around the house, you know, in terms of its cleanliness or its organization or something, and there are promises of auspiciousness if you do it right, and inauspiciousness if you don't, just so that we become more sattvic and in our habits and so on. And then we hear the unexpected guest should be treated like God just arrived at your door, right? And in one sense, maybe the people that are doing that are thinking this could be God, and I better be careful, and you know, I better do everything right. But perhaps more essentially, what it's saying is that we should see God in everyone, yeah. And we should cultivate that deep spiritual realization through being very eager to serve guests and receive guests. Yeah. And then when we get to that ultimate book, of yoga, it's showing that again and again in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, especially as I kind of suggested, it's understood this is duty of the householders. Their raison d'être, the reason they exist, is to, to accommodate others.
That's such a beautiful point. You know, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on today, Marsh, was to highlight a course that you are sharing with Professor Ravi Gupta.
Yes.
Who I've been, if people that have been listening, I've been referring to Ravi Gupta, Radhika Raman Prabhu's. He's also an Oxford scholar. I've been referring to tapes that I've been listening to him a lot recently, tapes that were recorded. They're available on YouTube if you Google Radhika Ramana or Ravi Gupta and IVS, the ISKCON, or ISV, ISKCON Silicon Valley. Yeah. He's given some a few different wonderful courses there. But the two of you are coming together to present an online course for the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies that are available to everyone. And that course is called Bhagavad Purana, Sacred Text and Living Tradition. And I'll just briefly read the description of this. It says, a vibrant example of living literature, the Bhagavad Purana, often referred to as Srimad Bhagavatam, is a hugely popular Hindu sacred text written in Sanskrit verse. It has inspired major North Indian bhakti traditions as well as schools of dance and drama, and continues to permeate popular Hindu art and ritual in India and the diaspora. In this course, we examine the Bhagavad Purana's key themes and its extensive influence on Hindu thought and practice. First, we'll see how the text develops major Hindu philosophical ideas, social dynamics, the psychology of self-realization, and cosmology, all with a central focus on devotion or bhakti to the Supreme, specifically as Vishnu, Narayana, Krishna. We will then look at the text as a living tradition through various media, including oral recitation, dramatic and dance performance, and by translation and publication in and beyond India. This course is based on the edited collection Bhagavad Purana, Sacred Text and Living Tradition. Students will receive an electronic copy of the book. This course is produced by the book's editors, Professor Ravi Gupta and Dr. Kenneth Valpy, and who will also be tutoring the course for its presentation in April 2024. So this is a course that begins at the end of this month. It's an online course. I highly recommend this. If we read Bhagavatam every day together here on the podcast, and if you'd like to take that interest a bit deeper, so that when you come and you hear the podcast, you understand it on a level that you haven't previously, I would highly recommend this course. It begins, the way that it works, I really like this form of study, because I was fortunate to be able to take part in some of the courses that the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies put together called the Gaudiya Vaishnava Studies Program. And this is a similar method here, that there's a video that
little
you
different,
can watch, right?
A little different from what you experienced, but yes.
Well, similar in the sense that you can do your own study. You can prepare yourself with your own study. Yeah. And there's on-demand these videos that you can watch on your own time. Yeah. And then there are 5 tutoring sessions that are taking place. They begin late April, April 29th, and they go through early June and through June 2nd. It's a wonderful way to study. And you know, really the most qualified teachers on this. So to find that, you can go to the website. It's Oxford Center for Hindu Studies Online, OCHSonline.org. And you can search for the Bhagavad Purana Sacred Text and Living Tradition. And Mary,
I can also link that in the show notes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what I was about to ask. People can find it there. Any last words you'd like to share, Marge, as our time is winding
well,
up?
Well, thank you for plugging our course. I couldn't have done it better.
okay. Well, you did.
And thank you for having me on. It's so nice what you're doing. You're reaching so many of just the right people, I think, with your podcast. So all power to you. Keep it up.
Oh, thank you so much for that blessing. Yeah, it is a wonderful group of people. And I hope I have received you somewhat well here this morning. That I may receive your blessings. Thank you so much for coming on today. Real pleasure to have you here. Will you be coming to the United States anytime soon?
Not for the rest of this year.
Okay.
But as soon as possible.
Okay. I hope to see you sometime soon. Wonderful to have you here, Mark.
Thank you.
Where are you staying in the Oxford area? Is that where you spend most of your time?
No. I'm in Poland.
Oh, that's right. You told me you're in Poland.
I was, of course, in Oxford for so many years, but circumstances kind of made it easier for me to be where I am now. And I go to Oxford usually a couple of times a year.
Okay. With big conferences and scholarly functions, I assume.
Mainly just to rub
the
elbows and shoulders with the devotees there. Yeah.
Nice. Do you still occasionally visit the Far East?
Since COVID, I've been once since COVID to Hong Kong. But yeah, I'm in touch with devotees through electronic means, and we'll see what the future brings.
Okay. Very good. We didn't even get into your background, where you grew up and all of that, but...
Well,
you're quite the global person, right?
If
really, because you lived in Germany for some time, but you're originally from the United States.
If you have another slot sometime, you don't know who to fill it with, you can call me up and we can talk about that, and we can talk about the cow's book and whatever.
Yes, we never got to the cow, so we'll have to do that on another occasion.
And hopefully the next book, Yoga and Animal Ethics.
Yoga and animal
ethics.
Wonderful. Such an important topic, actually. Marge, thank you so much again.
My thanks to you.
Thank you, all our listeners, for being with us this morning. And as Raghunath would say, it's a beautiful day. Let the magic continue.